Yeah, there were some questions about whether today's lecture will be on the exam. Yes, to a reasonable extent. And Monday's lecture will be on the exam, too. Okay. So today we were going to talk about communicating molecular structures in diagrams and words. But it says preliminary there, because there's some other things we're going to talk about as well. Now, with respect to configurational nomenclature, we talked about the tartaric acid and how you could have a mesoisomer, which had a mirror plane in the middle so that it was not optically active. But then you could have these two optically active isomers, which were identical. For example, their melting points were the same, except in the sign of the way they rotated polarized light. We have to give names to those so you know which one you're talking about. The easiest way to name them is phenomenologically, that is, whether they rotate the light as it comes toward you to the right at the top or to the left at the top, that is, clockwise or counterclockwise as the polarized light comes toward you. So those have the name dextro from Latin for right, or levo, Latin for left, so little d, little l. And also sometimes plus or minus. Those things are mean the same thing. D means the same as plus. L means the same as minus. Sometimes, as on the labels of the samples of carbone we passed out, it says both D and plus, right? Which is, of course, redundant because those mean the same thing. Now, there's another question of if you have three samples in bottles, how could you label them and know which they are? Okay, so the meso is clearly the one that has a mirror plane, right, and is not optically active. And then you have two samples that are optically active, and sure enough, you can label them plus and minus, or D and L. But you'd like to know what structure do you draw for them? Which Fischer structure do you draw? Do you draw it that way, with the D one having the OH on the bottom to the right? Or might it be the D isomer has the OH to the left on the bottom, right? Which one is it? Now, from some points of view, you might not need to know, which is a good thing, because it's impossible, it would seem, to know which is which. You'd have to have a microscope that could actually see these things to know which is right and which is left, and everybody knows that you don't have such a microscope. Now, you might say, you have X-ray. But it turns out that normal X-ray diffraction is not sensitive to whether something is right or left-handed. An object in its mirror image will, to a first approximation, give the same X-ray diffraction pattern. There is a very subtle difference called anomalous dispersion that we may talk about a little bit later on. But in fact, I'll talk about it in the next slide. But we won't talk about the principles that underlie it. But at first it seemed, as in so many cases, impossible to know. Impossible to know that molecules are composed of atoms. Impossible to know how atoms are hooked together, what the constitutional structure is. Impossible to know how atoms are arranged in space, whether carbons are tetrahedral. Impossible to know, if they're tetrahedral, which one of these two structures corresponds, these two Fischer structures. That means the OH and the H are coming out toward you, remember. Impossible to know which one is D and which one is L. Now, Fischer was aware of this impossibility, so he decided on a nomenclature system that would be relative, and it'd be genealogical in its nature, and you'll see what I mean here. So he took one molecule, a carbon which has attached four different things, CH2OH, H, OH, and CHO, four different things attached to that carbon atom. Okay? And now it's going to be optically active. It's called glyceraldehyde, right? And he takes the one that rotates light to the right, so it's D plus. Okay? And he arbitrarily decides which way it is, because there's no way really of knowing. Okay, so he arbitrarily decides that that is the configuration of D plus glyceraldehyde. And now that he knows that, or guessed that, he can use genealogy. He can do chemical transformations to convert that compound into other compounds and know which way they are. For example, he could he could take this compound and do a multi-step synthesis in which that carbon becomes that carbon. So he's added these new things up at the top. He's changed CHO into all that stuff. But in the process, this stayed the same. It was untouched. So if it started from D-glyceraldehyde and that got that molecule, he would call that molecule D-tartaric acid. But not in the same sense as this D-tartaric acid. That means the way it rotates light. The capital D means which glyceraldehyde did it come from. If he had started from the other glyceraldehyde, the one with OH on the left and H on the right, then by the same synthesis method, he would have gotten this one, right? So this one is called capital D, and that one would be called capital L, which seems just fine. I mean, it would be better to know really what it is, but since there's no way of knowing, this is second best. You guess one compound and then relate everything to it. Now, of course, it's not such a great nomenclature system because suppose you did a different kind of synthesis and converted this carbon into that carbon and added this stuff on the bottom in place of that CH2OH. Then you would have called this one capital D tartaric acid because it was made from D glyceraldehyde, right? So the problem with this nomenclature is how are you going to know what synthetic, you have to specify the synthetic method in order to know what name to give something. And if you used a different synthetic method, you'd get a different name. That obviously has its drawbacks. Be much better had you not had to make this guess and had there been actual tools that would tell you which one is, which structure is right-handed and which structure is left-handed. Okay, now one way you might say is to use fancy quantum mechanics to figure out which way a thing should rotate light. That turns out to be exceedingly difficult. And we'll have a lecture next Friday after the exam about people who are working to do that, to try to figure out using optical rotation which structure will rotate to the right and which to the left and by how much. And you'll see that it's extremely difficult to do. Okay, that's one way. Another way is to try to use X-ray diffraction. Is it truly impossible to know which is which? Well, in fact, it's not. And 75 years after Van 't Hoff had this idea that carbon was tetrahedral and provided evidence for it, another Dutchman, working incidentally in the lab that bore Van 't Hoff's name by that time, the Van 't Hoff Laboratory in Utrecht, did a very fancy kind of X-ray diffraction study on sodium rubidium salt of tartaric acid, of D-tartaric acid. Incidentally, notice that D-tartaric acid is L. What does that green L mean? It means that Fischer synthesized this particular tartaric acid from L-glyceraldehyde. Right? This is a genealogical name. And the lowercase is a phenomenological name, which way it rotates the light. Okay, but anyhow, he did this fancy thing called X-ray anomalous dispersion and had this figure in his paper, which shows the absolute orientation in space, not a Fischer projection anymore. There's OH, and there's H, there's carbon, there's acid attached to it, and here's the other half of the molecule. So he actually was able to determine this. Now, this is both the methods of calculating rotation, which we'll talk about next Friday, and this X-ray anomalous dispersion are pretty sophisticated techniques and not easy to understand. You wonder if there might be a simple way that anybody could understand to determine which one is right and which one is left. Right? So this, incidentally, this study by Byfoot proved 60 years late, that 60 years after Fischer made his guess, that he guessed right. Which is really handy because now you don't have to go back and correct everything that was done before 1950 and change which one it was. So that was a handy thing. Okay, so Fischer was right. And Byfoot then noted that you have to figure out some way to do nomenclature that's of this kind of nomenclature, not little d or capital L, things like that, but things that really tell what the molecule looks like. Now one wonders if there were, as I said, whether there might be other ways of doing this. Here was another thing that was difficult to know, is how what are electrons like in the bond? Was Lewis's structure correct, right? Shared pair bonds. Do you remember this one from earlier in the course? You remember what happened was they did the X-ray difference densities on this for different kinds of bonds and showed that indeed they correlated just as you might expect, but that the scale was different, that it was only a 20th of a Lewis. You remember that? Do you remember who did it? Or where they did it? I clicked too soon. It was Professor Lazarevich and Ziva Berkovich-Yellen at the Weizmann Institute. They did this in 1977. Well, Professor Lazarevich has subsequently applied his skills, as it says here, to solving a number of other challenging problems in X-ray diffraction, crystal packing, crystal growth, to address the question of determining the absolute chirality. Can you, by macroscopic observations, determine which one is right and which one is left, other than these indirect X-ray and optical rotation techniques? And more recently, he's studying the possibility that preventing crystal nucleation could make malaria parasites poison themselves with the dissolved heme byproduct that they generate by living off their host's hemoglobin. So he's going to give the class a brief synopsis of some aspects of his recent work. Les?
Thank you very much. Very quick, and so I can get started right there.
Okay, let me just put this on there. Just a second. Okay, and put this in your pocket, and you're set to go.
Okay. Okay, so I I prepared this morning, and I haven't looked at this for ages, and the figure's not, I don't think it's large enough, but I, that's so. Well, you know, we believed in doing simple things. And I used to do crystallography and determined absolute configuration using the Beaufort method. I did it once, and that was enough. It was so complicated. So complicated. It's like, you know, once when Einstein, he used to visit these families, and always they would ask him, can he explain the theory of relativity, right? And then he would say, well, he would say, there was two friends, they walked down a hot and dusty road one summer, and one of the friends was blind. And the man who wasn't blind said, oh, for a cup of cold milk. And the blind man said, well, what is milk? Oh, milk is a white liquid. And what is white? Asked the blind man. A white is the color of a bird's feather, swan's feather. And what is a swan? And swan is a bird with a long, crooked neck. And what is crooked? Asked the blind man. And his friend said, took his arm, he said, this is straight, and that's crooked. And then the blind man says, oh, now I know what milk is. And that was always the doing, signing absolute configuration a la Beaufort. And so we looked for a very simple method. We were working and using, looking at morphology of crystals, which was sort of black magic in those days. But yes, okay. Let's look at this. This is a normal crystal, right? These are the normal faces. These two, and so you have the four diagonal faces and you have the two side faces. Now let's say that I could grow this crystal. This is the unaffected shape, unaffected growth rate of the way a crystal grows. It goes much faster along B than along A. Now let's say I could inhibit growth along these four diagonal faces. By having some additive in solution that will stick to these four diagonal faces and prevent the growth, but it won't prevent the growth of the two of the A-type faces. But when you inhibit growth along the B-type faces, you're going to end up with such a morphology. So it means what we do, we used to work backwards. We said that we start off with a shape like this. And if you introduce the additive and you get a shape like that, then you know that the additive had absorbed on the four diagonal faces.
So the people at the back hear well?
Can you hear me? Okay, good. So now let's say that I was... the type of additives that we use, I don't want to discuss capping molecules because we prepared this talk this morning, it was all so quick. I wanted to talk about what's called tailor-made additives. In other words, the additive is tailor-made, it's tailored for the actual crystal. Now, this is the normal crystal structure, right? So you have these two little men here, they sort of related by an inversion center. In other words, my right-handed molecule, my left-handed molecule are related by inversion symmetry. And the pair of molecules, this pair, is related to that pair by translation, and you have, this is your crystal structure, right? And this is the shape of the norm, this is the shape of the crystal, so this crystal goes much faster along the vertical direction than it grows along the horizontal direction, and you see it, that's this rectangle. Now, let's say that I want to inhibit growth along the vertical direction, right? So what you do is, forget about the capping molecule, so I will prepare a tailor-made additive that is like the normal molecule, but it has a hat on top. And can you see that, say, for example, the right-handed molecules, or let's say the green molecules will, the additive will have its hat pointing upwards, and this type of molecule, which I call the left-handed molecule, will have its hat and will only be, so the right-handed molecules can only be absorbed on the top face, and the left-handed molecules can only be absorbed at the bottom face. But once this molecule is absorbed, it will inhibit, retard the regular growth of the crystal, because as oncoming molecules come, the hat will prevent oncoming molecules, because you can see this is where the hat would have been, right? So it would prevent oncoming molecules, and so it would prevent growth in the vertical direction. Is this point clear? I think it should be quite simple. And so therefore you end up with a morphology like that. And so you have the growth inhibited crystal. And so we use this technique for assigning the absolute configuration of molecules in the crystal. And we did this with center symmetric crystals. And I'm going to give you a simple example. And that is, I take a centersymmetric crystal, and a centersymmetric crystal is a crystal that has a right-hand constituent molecule and a left-handed molecule, and they will form pairs, dimers, and say this is my right-handed molecule and this is my left-handed molecule, and these pairs constitute the crystal. Now, so what is interesting about X-ray diffraction? Now, I have chosen as my constituent molecule glycine. Now, glycine itself is not chiral. The molecule, you can see it has, there's the carboxylate group, there's the amino group, there's the central carbon atom. Now, if I were to replace this hydrogen here, one of these two hydrogens by, say, a methyl group, then this molecule would become chiral and it would have a particular handedness. Now, this molecule here, this glycine molecule here, and that glycine molecule here, or in other words, this glycine molecule in the crystal and that glycine molecule are related by a center of inversion, right? My right hand to my left hand. And all that I'm doing is, I'm taking this molecular pair and I'm translating it in the crystal along the horizontal direction, And then I'm doing other kind of sympathy elements. I'm doing the rotation sympathy element. And so the red face, the top face of this crystal, exposes this hydrogen to the surface. As you can see, that's this hydrogen here. And these, and the green molecules, which I label S, expose that hydrogen. But these two molecules are related by a centered inversion, like my right hand to my left hand. Okay? And you can see it once again here. This is so. Now this here is the morphology of the crystal, the crystal structure with its related morphology, and the morphology of this crystal is shown here, and it's kind of a bipyramid. So you have the red face on top, and the green face at the bottom. The red face exposes these hydrogens to air, to the solution, and the bottom face exposes those hydrogens. Now let's say that I grew this solution of glycine in the presence of amino acids, chiral amino acids of single-handedness, or right hand or left hand. In other words, let's say that I grew my crystals in the presence of amino acids which are D amino acids or R amino acids. In other words, it's as if this hydrogen here were replaced by, say, it would be glutamic acid, or it could be phenylalanine, or it could be glutamine. Where this hydrogen here would be replaced by a large group. And I would have, say, 3 or 4% of that additive in solution, but I don't know its handedness. I wouldn't know. Let's say Bayford hadn't done his experiment and I wanted to determine the handedness of that molecule. So, I grow the crystals in the presence of the solution, and lo and behold, I find that if I grow the crystals in the presence of the R amino acids, but I don't know it's R, I would find that I would inhibit growth on the top face, because as the additive is adsorbed on this face, it inhibits growth, regular growth, of oncoming molecules, oncoming glycine molecules, because it's stuck. Once adsorbed, it's stuck. And so I inhibit growth on the top face. That means that I look at this crystal, I see that the 010 face has been inhibited in growth. That means that this molecule, this R amino acid, can't be absorbed from the bottom face, right? Because on the bottom face, it would be this hydrogen that would be of R configuration, and that molecule cannot be adsorbed. The R molecule can only be adsorbed from the top face. Now, I now take, say, glutamic acid of opposite handedness. Let it be now the S molecule. I put it in solution, and I see that instead of having a pyramid of such a shape, it's the pyramid of opposite handedness. Can you see that these two pyramids are related by a mirror plane, right? And that means that if I get such a morphology, it means that the additive must be of S-handedness. If I take the R molecule and the S molecule, in other words, the left-handed molecule, and the right-hand, I grow glycine in the presence, say, of 4 or 5% of molecules of opposite-handedness, I will inhibit both the top face and the bottom face. Now, I can therefore do more. I can cut this crystal in two, right? The pyramid, I cut it in two. I can find the additive of one handedness on the top half, the additive, because let's say the stuff is being occluded, you understand me? I don't inhibit completely. I simply retard the growth. That means that the additive is there, but in stereo specifically, precise positions. See, if I cut the crystal in two, I take the top half, I dissolve it, take the bottom half and dissolve it. And so, but it's more than that. You see, this crystal structure is centrosymmetric, right? The normal crystal structure for every top molecule, for every pair, you have the right-handed pair, the right-handed molecule, and the left-handed molecule. But each half of such a crystal, the symmetry is dropped. Because in each half, you will not have, for some sites, you will not have the corresponding molecule of opposite handedness. You will only have in the top half, you will only have molecules, say, of R configuration. If I cut the crystal in two, that means that the crystal symmetry is stopped, and there are ways of determining the symmetry of a crystal very simply. By showing that its symmetry is dropped, and so I can check in various ways that we have and find, in fact, determine not only the handedness of the additive, but which site it has in fact occupied, and I can do it also by X-ray diffraction. So this is I think, I mean, that's about it, right?
I think you should say something about how this was received. What did people think about the possibility of doing such an experiment?
Well, I mean,
you're being recorded, remember. This is going to be online, so don't say anything defamatory.
Well, I spoke at a place in Switzerland. I forgot the name of this place. It's in the mountains. It was in May, the beginning of May, and we went to this meeting. I forgot the name of this meeting, but it was the opening of the summer season. And it was at the hotel where only the very rich go to such places. But at the beginning of the season, in order to test and in order to show the waiters and all the people who were working there, they did the experiments on us, you know, how to prepare food, how to polish your shoes, how to, you know, all the sort of stuff that goes with all the rich. And so we went to this meeting and I spoke about this. Now there is that lectures, it was called the joke lecture. But you didn't know which was the joke lecture at the beginning of the series. And when I finished my talk, there were those who said, there's something wrong, this guy is giving the joke lecture. But I was dead serious. And so, because there were people who believed it was impossible to assign the absolute configuration of a chiral molecule from the morphology of the crystal. And in fact, it was the beginning when Pasteur did his famous experiment, and he took what was one of the tartaric acids, and he got two crystals with opposite of opposite handedness in terms of morphology. You could determine, it was Beifuth who determined the absolute configuration of the constituent molecules, but there was a link that was missing with Beifuth. He wasn't able to directly correlate the handedness of the molecule with the shape of the crystal, and this is what we did. By looking at the change in shape of the crystal, we could determine the absolute handedness of the constituent molecules. And I think so for a long time people didn't believe it, but I think it's more or less accepted. It's so simple, right? Once it's explained to you, there's just nothing to it. I think it's like, you know, nothing to it. But we were a little late in the day, but I think Beifuth did it first, but it wasn't really Beifuth. There was a Japanese group in 1929 who took zinc sulfide. Now, zinc sulfide was the same sort of thing. You had a crystal, zinc layers, sulfur layers, and you didn't know from the crystal which was the zinc surface and which was the sulfur surface. And they did the experiment using anomalous dispersion of X-rays. And they determined, using the same method as Beifuth, rather the reverse, that they introduced this method and determined the absolute handedness of that. It's a polar crystal, it's not chirality, absolute structure. And Beifuth actually applied that same method, but he did it for absolute configuration. But I think, anything else you like? I'm so old.
Your other story now, you have 20 minutes left.
So I go to malaria now, if that's okay. Well, I want to speak about
Because there's chirality in that.
Yes, there's chirality, and you'll see how chirality, okay. So, I mean, the driving force here was really to, you know, there's a malaria. I mean, sure, you people have read that malaria is a re-emerging disease, right? Like tuberculosis and infectious disease. And malaria, it's this is the geographic distribution of malaria. And of course, it's endemic in both tropical and semi-tropical countries. But don't think you're off the hook, because there was a lot of malaria in temperate climates like Greece and Italy. And in fact, Oliver Cromwell, who was an Englishman, died of malaria, and he contracted it in England. So there was malaria in England, I think it was in the 17th century. It was all over. Now, the reason why it's so prevalent is that, I mean, there are 300 million infections per year and 1 to 2 million deaths, mostly children and pregnant women. And the reason is mainly poverty, of course. Then the other thing is that the anopheles mosquito was the vector, the carrier of the malaria parasite, has developed resistance to insecticides. And of course, malaria insecticides have developed resistance to many of the commonly used synthetic drugs, and so we were interested in the mechanism of action of these drugs. But I'm not going to speak about that. Now, just a few words about the life cycle of the malaria parasite. The anopheles mosquito injects about 10 to 15 parasites into the blood. These parasites then they find their way to the liver, and they spend it dormant there for about 10 days. There are no pathological manifestations of the diseases yet. Just multiply to some extent. And they call it schizons. I don't know what schizons means. It's like a cluster. And then these parasites, they then leave the liver and they enter the bloodstream. And they penetrate, each parasite penetrates the red blood cell for its source of amino acids. And it consumes up to 75% of hemoglobin in the red blood cell. That's a lot, 70%. Each, and in the red blood cell, this is a very important cycle, enters the red blood cell, it's called the ring stage, multiplies, and it forms, and then they divide and multiply, forms what's called the schizont, and then it ruptures the red blood cell, and then all that debris goes into the bloodstream, and that causes all the problems. Besides the fact that you're becoming anemic all the time. And it's a cycle, every 3 days, just carries on. Then of course there's some parasites that many they remain in the red blood cell, and then they're picked up once again by the parasite, and then there's by the anopheles mosquito, and then there's a cycle. So now I'm just going to speak about the infected red blood cell stage. And so this is the red blood cell. It's about 8 microns in diameter. Here's the digestive vacuole where all the action takes place. Now, as I mentioned, the parasite consumes 75% of the hemoglobin, but it leaves the heme. This is the heme, intact. But the heme is toxic to the parasite. So the parasite gets around the problem by sequestering it, by crystallizing it into an insoluble material called hemozone. And these crystals are submicron. And so in this way, the heme is no longer toxic to the parasite. Now, for a long time, it was believed that this is a polymer. But then the crystal structure was determined 10 years ago. I think I have just 1 minute, please. A slide is missing, but it doesn't matter. I prepared it this morning. A man called Scott Ball from Wyoming. In his group, they determined the crystal structure of the, and they found that it's a dimer. So you have the heme group, and the heme group dimerizes. In the food vacuole of the parasite, right? You have the heme, two hemes, they link, they form a coordination complex between the iron of the heme and an oxygen of the propionic acid and forms a dimer. And it is a dimer, then that crystallizes. Now, there's something very interesting. Oh, now they determine the crystal structure. And there was no disorder. What I mean by no disorder, you see, you have your vinyl group, you have a methyl group. Now this molecule has no symmetry, right? And now you have the vinyl group and the methyl group. And these groups, there was no disorder in the crystal structure. This is the crystal structure. Now here's the dimer. Now when you look at these groups, it's odd. If I have such a dimer, why don't I get the opposite dimer? You understand me? These two molecules come together, clop, but they could have done this. That means, and in fact there are four such isomers that could have been, that you can obtain. And I'm going to show them in the next slide.
Could you back up just once on the,
yeah, sure,
about the parallel to what, yeah, we've just been talking about? So when you go around this heme, you go two carbons, one carbon, two carbons, one carbon, clockwise. But you can imagine that molecule being upside down, in which case you'd go two carbons, one carbon, two carbons, one carbon. Right? So as you go around this part of the top, you can go either clockwise or counterclockwise. The same on the bottom. So you know how many isomers there'd be. Right? Just like what Van't Hoff showed last lecture, right? You could go clockwise around three things or counterclockwise around three things. So it's exactly what we talked about last time in terms of how many isomers. Thanks, Les.
Okay. Oh, I don't want to describe this. This is just a geometric way of what Michael has been talking about. You know, I have the one end of the molecule, the other end, but I want to show you the results. So, this is the isomer, the dimer, that Scott Bowl and co-workers obtained. But there's the opposite isomer, right? It's also centrosymmetric. I've interchanged these groups. Now, both are centrosymmetric. But I can also obtain a chiral isomer, shown here. In other words, the two faces, instead of being related by middle symmetry, they're related by rotation symmetry. Understand? Look. You have this end here is the same as that end. That end is the same as that end, right? This end here is related to that end by an inversion center, where this end is related to that by an inversion center. But now I simply exchange these two. So this end and that end are the same, and that end and that end. So it's as if the two faces of this dimer are related by rotation symmetry and not inversion symmetry. In other words, if I you must have seen Rodin's famous piece of art where he took two hands and he rotated them. And you think at first it's a left hand and right hand, but it's your two right hands. Takes this hand and that hand. You must have seen that. Or you must have seen a picture of somebody if you're interested in the arts. And so this dimer here and that dimer there are of opposite handedness, but each one is chiral, right? Each one is of single handedness. Now, all four dimers should have been prepared in the solution or in the food vacuole of the parasite. This was done synthetically. When Scott Bowl did this synthetically, he only reported this structure. So where are the other dimers? Where have they just gone to? In solution. They must have gone somewhere. So we said, well, let's try to determine this crystal structure. Let's redo the power. Let's measure powder data and determine the powder diffraction at low temperature. Because Scott Bowl did it at room temperature. So what we did was, so Tina Strasser, she wrote me, she wanted to do some work, and so we started working on this problem. So we took, it's called Betahematon. Now, normally these crystals, as I said, they only appear by the parasite, gives it only... Scott Boland, when they did the crystal, when they obtained crystals, it took weeks for them to crystallize the stuff. But normally the parasite does it in one day or even less than a day. So when we crystallize in solution, we did it very quickly. Crystals appeared after several hours. We took those crystals, we went to Japan, measured the data, the diffraction data. You take powder, you get diffraction data, also the peaks, diffraction peaks. And from this is the powder pattern, the diffraction pattern. But there's some peaks that couldn't be assigned. That's this peak here. It couldn't be assigned to this crystal structure. It had to belong to something else. There's one peak, another peak. It's just prepared very quickly. It was this peak, the red peak, this red peak, that peak, and that peak. Those peaks couldn't be assigned. And that meant it was another phase. There were two phases in this mixture that we had. There was the major phase, the crystal structure of which was known, the other cell dimensions, and the minor phase which we determined. And the minor phase constitutes 13% of the total amount. In other words, in solution, you have the major phase that crystallizes. And because there's an energy difference between the structures of the dimers and the minor phase. So now, why am I saying all this? In the parasite, you only obtain a single phase. So where the dimers gone to in the parasite? What happens in the parasite? That was the problem. So the powder diffraction of biogenic hemozone, that's hemozone in the parasite, shows only one phase. Now maybe it's related to the state of the heme in hemoglobin, because you have hemoglobin, right? There are four hemes in hemoglobin. Now if you look at hemoglobin, this is the crystal structure of the hemoglobin. There are four hemes. Now each heme, there's molecular oxygen bound to the iron, that's the oxygen, that's eventually the least that makes you move and makes you think, right? Now when you look at the structure, you can see that the molecular oxygen is bound to the heme only from one side. It's not bound from the other side. There's a histidine bound on the other side. When the globin is chewed up, it's digested by the parasite, the heme is left intact. So if the heme is left intact with molecular oxygen only on one side, when it dimerizes, it can only dimerize from one face. That means you can only get one single isomer, because the face, it's always the same. So you should only obtain this single isomer. But remember, this crystal structure of this isomer is so similar to the crystal, the molecular structure of this isomer is so similar to the molecular structure of the centrosymmetric dimer that there's almost no difference in crystal structure between. In other words, if I have a molecule, if I have a crystal structure where this molecule is the primary constituent, now that crystal structure should be very similar to the crystal structure of the centrosymmetric one. But now there's something very funny here. People took the powder from hemozone and they tried to determine the crystal structure of that powder. But they assumed the crystal structure was centrosymmetric. And so that if you put in junk, you end up with junk, right? You understand what I'm saying? The constituent molecule is chiral of single-handedness. You assume when you go into a structure refinement, they put in something, but they assumed that the symmetry was centrosymmetric. That means that you're behind the eighth ball from the very beginning. So they obtained a molecular dimer, which had to be centrosymmetric, even though the constituent molecules was primarily chiral. But there's one more little thing here. These crystals are so small. Why? Why is it submicron? Why isn't the crystal, say, 50 microns size? Why isn't it 1 millimeter? Why? The reason is very simple. How much time? How many more minutes do I have, Michael?
You have 30 seconds. But so this is all that people are responsible for.
Okay.
Within reason, you're responsible.
Okay.
For it, okay. But if you need to leave now, go ahead. But you can talk.
Okay. In the solution, you have this chiral dimer. But you have other dimers to a small extent. These dimers act as tailor-made inhibitors to the crystal. So the crystal, the growth is always being inhibited because not all dimers are of the same head. And the reason is the parasite invades the red blood cell. It doesn't invade arterial blood, it invades venous blood, right? When you're in, you know, and now I ask you, in venous blood, what is the oxygen content of venous blood? Have a guess. No oxygen. You'd be dead. You start off with the arterial blood, 100% oxygen, right? Your venous blood contains 70% oxygen. Only great athletes have, say, 40%, 50%. Those are the athletes who come first. Right? The other athletes who have, say, 50%, 60%, they come last. Now, but why does a parasite do it? Why does a parasite invade venous blood? This you must know. Because the parasite wants to keep you alive until it takes your globin. Once it chews up your globin, it first releases oxygen, 100% to 70%, and then it chews up, then it takes your amino acid. But it wants to keep you kicking and alive, just barely alive. And it means that you'll have some of the dimers formed will be of opposite handedness, centrosymmetric, and they will inhibit the growth of those crystals and make them very small. I've given you I sometimes describe a cannon as a piece of iron with a hole inside, and you have to know that I mean a cannon. Sometimes I don't speak clearly, but Michael is here to put me on the right path. Okay, thank you very much. Thank you.
Huh? You covered the stereochemistry we need to cover. That's good.
Okay, good.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Do you want to make an announcement about what review sessions you're going to have?
I'm going to do a review for the exam on Monday, in place of the review session Monday evening. And I meant to ask Philip, could you do Tuesday sometime? We'll find out some other time. But anyhow, I'm going to do the session Monday evening.
Okay, we can get you. I'm going off here.
Yeah, sure.
Hand me this thing.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.